Hi, I'm Samantha, a past guest on CJAM's Handy Link. You're listening to Handy Link on CJAM 99.1 FM, reaching high ground in Windsor, Detroit.
Welcome to Handy Link, sponsored by the Italian-Canadian Handy Capable Association. I'm your host, Cam Wells. In this segment of our show, we'll hear from Jasmine Moretti and Andrea Dent from Epilepsy Halton Peel Hamilton. This is a post-dated interview, folks, so some of the events referred to may already have passed. So tell me a little bit about the latest happenings with Epilepsy Halton Peel Hamilton.
So for my job, so it's Jasmine speaking. So I'm the program manager slash client services, but I'm also the camp director for our Sunny Days Camp. So our Sunny Days Camp is, we run it July and August, 3 days a week. For kids with epilepsy and their siblings, so ages 5 to 12. So we're nearing the end of our summer with the kids, but that's pretty much what my summer has consisted of, just a summer camp for these kids and giving them the opportunity to create social bonds and memories that they don't get to in school, just due to social isolation due to their epilepsy or bullying. Because of having seizures in school or the fear of having a seizure. So we do a field trip every Wednesday, and yesterday we actually had the opportunity to go to Adventure Village, for their last field trip, which was an amazing experience. They did a lot of low ropes and high ropes courses where they were able to build a lot of self-esteem and self-confidence through these activities. So that's what I've been doing in the summer, and Andrea will let you know what she's been doing lately.
So my name's Andrea Dent, and I'm the youth coordinator here at Epilepsy Halton Peel Hamilton. The youth coordinator is a fairly new position, and what I've been doing essentially is I've actually created a program for youth and young adults who are diagnosed with epilepsy, or it's also open to the siblings of those who have epilepsy. So a lot of times we'll also have people come who maybe they don't have epilepsy, but their sibling does. And they're also welcome to attend even if their sibling isn't attending the program. So the program is for people 16 to 30 years of age. And we focus on a lot of different things. We focus on building life skills. A lot of the times, opportunities that they maybe haven't had that other people who haven't been diagnosed with epilepsy have. So, for example, with finding a job, a lot of times people struggle with finding a job because their employers maybe don't understand their medical condition and don't want to give that position to those people. So a lot of times we do build those skills and help them with that. We also do a lot of events and just social skills, so getting them into the community and letting them have the same opportunities that people have every day. So, for example, going bowling or going to the movies, going swimming, these are all activities and events that we've either done already or that we're planning to do over the next 8 months. The best part about going out into the community and doing these things in a group is that if someone does have a seizure while they're in the public, they're around a bunch of other people who also have seizures, and they're in a very supportive environment. So we have had clients have seizures with us while we're on programming, and it's a totally different experience for them, because when they awake from their seizure, rather than feeling panic, they feel supported because there's people there who are able to help them and who then we're able to give them their space, where a lot of times people in the community, when they see someone have a seizure, they panic themselves, and even though the person is telling them, I'm okay, the people might not always listen to what they're saying, where this time it was totally different because everyone in the program was like, okay, you say you're good. We know you're okay because you know your body. So it's just very empowering for them to really be in an environment where they can make connections with other people who've gone through similar situations to them, and make those connections, make long-lasting friendships with people who really understand what they're going through. We're also working on doing some stuff within the community and giving back. So we're going to be doing a clothing drive, and we're also going to be helping pack food bags around the holiday season in December. We're doing a whole bunch of things, and we're even having a family and youth retreat, which is going to be taking place in September. It's going to be educational, and it's also going to be tons of fun. They're going to be doing some rock climbing, having bonfires in the evening. So we really do a variety of things, and our main focus is just trying to assist those youth and young adults with whatever aspect in their life they feel they're struggling in, whether that's social, employment, or financial. We really just want to get them to a level where they feel confident in themselves to be able to achieve their goals and, you know, create the best future for themselves, where they feel independent and they feel that they're happy with where they are.
So in your time with Epilepsy Holton Peel Hamilton, what would you say is the greatest success you've encountered?
Well, I've seen so many successes in the short time that I've been here. That is really a tough question. I would say, personally, the success that I've seen, at least within my program, is those small moments when someone comes to you and they say, this is the first time that I've felt understood. Because even though they have friends and family who say, oh, I support you, I understand where you're coming from, it's not the same as meeting someone else who's the same age as you and who also experiences the same type of seizure as you, or who also has epilepsy and is facing the same struggles as you. There's nothing more amazing for me than seeing two youth come together and actually be able to connect and have a conversation where they're smiling and they're talking about their diagnosis at the same time. It's absolutely amazing, and for me it's so empowering to see those people being able to make those connections together. Because it's such a small thing, right? I mean, it's not like something where we're donating a large amount of money to someone. This is such a small thing that we're making such a big difference with just getting together and just meeting together, having support groups, even if we're not out in the community. It's such a small thing just being able to bring people together, but it makes such a big difference for them.
So it's more human-centered support than financial-centered.
Absolutely. I mean, there are lots of things that we help with financially within Epilepsy Holton Peel Hamilton. However, with this program specifically, even when we do provide the programming at minimal or no cost, I think the most amazing thing for me is being able to just watch people make those connections. So even though we do help provide programming for people without it being a financial cost to them, we do help in that sense, but for me, I think the part that I love the most about the program is just watching people make those connections. Because the program itself, it usually doesn't cost anything. It's minimal or no cost, and we do provide assistance with transportation, so helping people with transit. A lot of times people don't have their driver's license when they have epilepsy. So we do absolutely provide tons of support in that sense financially, but the part that stands out to me so much is just watching those connections be formed.
Well, that is of equal importance to anything you could do financially. When you reach
Absolutely.
A person, it's one of the deepest impacts you can make, really.
Absolutely.
I'd like to thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Thank you.
During the interview, folks, one of the key points in all of disability life was touched upon. It is critical for a person with a disability to meet those of similar ability levels, similar background in terms of their condition. It's one thing to have society say, we support you, we'll provide this, that, and the other for you. But emotional connection, true understanding, realizing for the very first time that you're not the only one. That can be life-changing. That's something a person with a disability should experience at some point in their life. The worst thing you can possibly do as a person with a disability is cut yourself off from society and say, people don't want to look upon me because I'm different, because I might move a little differently, I might think a little differently, I might speak a little differently. That is only punishing yourself. And if I may, I would argue that makes the disability even worse. But forging that connection, getting out there, speaking to someone who can truly say with a voice of experience, yes, I understand. And yes, there may be some options you don't yet know about. That is where this change begins. Truth of the matter is, understanding about a disability, it's a lifelong process, both for society of people with disabilities and for their able-bodied counterparts. No one goes into a situation knowing everything about every condition. Fact is, for the able-bodied, sometimes there can be misunderstandings, or even between people with disabilities. But going in with an open mind, saying, this person might have something valuable to add. They might have something to say that can help rewrite my story. That, too, is key. But especially when a person with a disability meets someone for the first time, is at their level, their own age, similar abilities, they come to understand that it's a part of life, but it is not all-defining, and it doesn't have to be that which isolates you from the community. That is something no one should ever, ever inflict upon themselves. It's one of the greatest tragedies I've seen in disability life. And it's so preventable. If there's something that you don't understand, ask questions. If you think something is possible to make things better, it may very well be. But pool your ideas, pool your resources. Go to events. Take the time to talk to people with disabilities about your condition, and even the able-bodied. Fact is, bridges of understanding, where it all begins. HandyLink will be right back after these commercial messages, so stay tuned.
The Green Bean Cafe is Windsor's independent cafe specializing in fair trade, organic, and premium coffee products. Along with our delicious coffee, we serve other great food and drinks, like tea, fresh baked goods, sandwiches, and more. Visit us on the lower level of 2320 Wyandotte Street, across from the new engineering building. Summer hours are 9 a.m. to 6 p.m. Get more information at greenbeancoffee.ca.
Welcome back to HandyLink, sponsored by the Italian-Canadian Handy Capable Association. I'm your host, Cam Wells. Earlier in our show, we heard from Jasmine Moretti and Andrea Dent from Epilepsy Holton Peel Hamilton. In this segment of our show, we'll hear from Duran Wong Rieger from the Canadian Organization for Rare Disorders. So tell me a little bit about the Organization for Rare Disorders.
The Canadian Organization for Rare Disorders is a national network. Most of our members are actually rare disease organizations, so they themselves represent individuals with rare diseases. Some of these are very, very small groups, and they may be just family-based. Some of them are large, like Muscular Dystrophy Association, Cystic Fibrosis, which, quite frankly, have a lot more resources than we do as a network. What we do as a network is we try to certainly support the groups, but we also work on national policy. We work on issues that would be common to all the groups. And we also include raising awareness around rare diseases, fighting for legislation to support rare diseases, access to screening, testing, diagnosis for rare diseases as well as treatment, care, support on behalf of all the rare diseases. And we also support the member groups. We provide training. We do educational seminars with them and do some real training in terms of not only policy issues but also running a small organization.
Would this also include things like clearing up any myths surrounding rare conditions?
You know, our challenges with regard to rare diseases is that there are some 7,000 rare diseases. So this is a challenge to begin with. Not all of them have a test that go along with them. So there are lots of myths around rare diseases. But there are also some real challenges with regard to getting the right information, because a lot of times we don't even know the right information.
So, when you mentioned policy and legislation change, can you give me an example of something that you're pushing?
And this is something that's so important. You know, Canada is still the only developed country without orphan drug legislation, which means that we don't actually have an official definition of a rare disease. We have no support in terms of research and development on therapies for rare diseases. We have no official policies that really talk about how do we screen for or test or providing centers of support for rare diseases. In some respects, one would have to say rare diseases kind of doesn't even exist in Canada. We've been fighting for orphan drug legislation to support creating therapies for rare diseases for many, many years. The U.S. brought in their legislation in 1983, European Union in 1999, 2000, Japan, somewhere in the mid-1990s. Most other countries have some form of support for rare diseases. We are still fighting to get that into our system here.
So, in your time with the organization, has there been any success moment that stood out for you?
Excuse me. Yeah, sure. We've had huge, what you might call success moments. I mean, I came in about 2006. We put forth a draft orphan drug legislation. I mean, the sad news is that we really did wake up the government. We got them engaged. We got them involved. We got them to draft a regulatory framework. And, in fact, it was promised somewhere back in 2012 by the health minister. It is sitting ready to be implemented. All it has to do is be submitted to Parliament to actually be able to become the regulations of the land, and yet politically there's been some stalling on it. So we've had huge opportunities to move that forward, get recognition for it. Another big issue, obviously, is getting access to the drugs as they're being developed. They tend to be expensive on an individual basis. The government have promised us certainly to have a platform that would look at how do we fund these drugs in a way that is not going to penalize individuals. We have had one of the major successes is this past year, the health ministers finally agreed on a core list of rare diseases that they would screen for. This means that they will give every newborn in Canada, it's basically a blood test that you take a drop of blood, and they test it for diseases that could be rare. The diseases are rare, but with one test, they can actually test for many diseases. In the U.S., they can test for up to about 60 to 100 diseases. We typically, in Canada, test for as few as 6 and as many as 30 in some provinces, but we've never had national standards. They finally agreed that we will put out a core list. Hasn't been fully implemented, but at least we're getting there. So those are huge steps forward for a country that is still trying to figure out whether or not it wants to actually recognize people with rare diseases and to give them that same level of support treatment.
So in terms of the push forward, what are the next immediate steps?
Well, one of the things we're asking people to do, and we have it on our website, is write to your parliamentary representative, your member of parliament, write to the health minister and say we need those orphan drug regulations now. We need to have them implemented. It will be a signal for our researchers and developers to really get involved in developing therapies. It also will help us in terms of, most importantly, getting clinical trials in Canada. Sometimes our patients are, up to 6 years waiting for a clinical trial that's, already the drug's already been completed and approved elsewhere. So we are really far behind in getting access to our patients. And that can be a tragedy if you're talking about a progressive disease. because every day, every week, every year that you delay, it's less an opportunity that you're actually going to be able to halt the progression or even save a person's life with a rare disease. So go into the website, read on the petition that we've got, sign the petition, but also send the letter to your MP and say we need to have those regulations now. We're working on trying to get an access framework, and we really encourage people to, again, write to your provincial government to support the need for a access framework for therapies that are already available for rare diseases, to find some way of making a national program that would allow us to bring those drugs in a way that, you know, regardless of where you live in Canada, you could get access to it. So we want people to take some political action with us. Obviously, we hope we want people to support in raising awareness. Individually, one of the things that can happen is for people to be aware that there are rare diseases. In many cases, it can take up to 12 years to get a diagnosis, and that's because physicians are not really attuned to rare diseases. So it's up to the patient sometimes to really not only find the information, but to also convince their clinician, their physician, to continue to maybe do further testing, refer them for testing, to not dismiss symptoms that are not easily understood, or to just suggest that the patients may not be fully, you know, aware of what they're experiencing, and to deny the existence. Be persistent, look it up, find other people, you know, oftentimes through the social media, for instance. So there's a lot that people can do. We host two conferences a year that are national. We host a lot of other seminars, et cetera, webinars as well. If they're on our website and they want to join our mailing list, we really encourage people to get involved so that we can keep them informed and, you know, they can add their voice but also inform themselves.
In terms of self-advocacy, when you mention that these patients should keep pushing till they get the answers, what advice would you give them in terms of dealing with a medical professional?
You know, for the most part, physicians want to be helpful. They really want to do the best they can for their patients. The challenge is that we do not resource our physicians to be able to do that. They're paid on a fee-for-service basis, so they have a limited amount of time they can give to each patient. And we know that with a rare disease, it takes a lot of time. And it makes it very difficult under the system that we've got. So you have to be persistent, understand that your physician wants to help, but there are limits. So book extra time, really do your own homework. And there's a lot of information that can be available on websites now. We have sources that we can refer the physician to where they can begin to get connected to either finding a diagnosis. There are websites that actually help you to try to narrow down what that rare disease can be based on the symptoms, and there are specialists that we can refer them to. What we don't have in Canada yet are what we call centers of excellence in specific rare diseases, where we can genuinely refer a patient, get them properly hooked up to a specialist, get them to the right test, but that's what we're working on. But short of that, you know, they can actually do a lot themselves to try to get the information to their clinician, you know, and don't give up. You know, give as much opportunity as you can for that clinician to do the right thing. And if you're not getting the answers that you want, you know, you may need to find somebody else who's willing to work with you.
When you mentioned doing one's own homework and doing the research, I would assume that that means a competent, reputable source. There's a lot of misinformation out there concerning any condition.
Mm-hmm. Well, that is a big challenge. There are some good resources that even tell you how to figure out what a good resource is, and we're developing an advocacy toolkit ourselves that would actually help, for instance, patients to assess the information they're getting on a website to see, one, if this is a good website, and two, how can they test that information with regard to how valid or legitimate it might be. So you're very right. There's a lot of garbage out there. But there's more and more. There are really good patient networks. There are rare disease groups that are out there. The nice thing is that they are international, so even if it's a fairly rare disease, you're likely to find somebody that might have that similar disease. So part of it is putting in, you know, trying to narrow it down enough that you can get to that right patient community. So there are resources, and we have linkages to some of those resources on our website, but it really is a challenge. you know, no doubt about it, we're not there yet in terms of having a good, you know, referral line or help line for patients. But there are ways of, you know, sorting through it, and some guides that can be helpful in terms of how do you decide whether that information you're getting is legitimate information or not.
Like to thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Yeah, thanks, Dan.
Of course. I've said it 100 million times, and I'll say it 100 million more. Monitoring. That's the key. When it comes to any policies, it is not enough to say we have a plan for rare diseases and then just have it sitting there collecting dust. It's not enough. Because while to some health minister or some politician somewhere, this is simply a form, something to sign off on. To those affected with these conditions, that's life and death. That's how they live their lives every day. The question then becomes, what quality of life are we offering? Are we giving these good people all that we can? Or are we going to overlook that because it's inconvenient or because it might be a political hotbed? The fact of the matter is, we have no right to turn our backs on those affected. We need a policy. We need to get things rolling. Because with certain conditions, in the early stages, in its onset, it might be treatable, it might be manageable. But how long are we willing to wait? How much damage are we going to let happen to a person before we say, this has to stop, this has to change? We don't need to create our own tragedies, folks. When it's so simple. You get people together, pooling ideas, pooling resources. You have a plan. That's good. Use it. Don't waste what could be a good thing to get in motion. Hearing that we can screen for all these conditions, that's a good thing. That's a wonderful thing. Why are we not taking the time to be as effective as we possibly can? When a new life enters the world, it enters with potential to do or to be anything. And if we can screen out something that may hinder them down the road, why in the world wouldn't we do it? Are we going to look into the eyes of that newly born child and say, sorry, kid, we don't care enough to take the 5 minutes, take a sample of your blood and maybe end up saving your life? We're going to give you a life, but it's not going to be completely the quality that you deserve or can expect. Because, in effect, if we're not screening and we don't have something in place, that is exactly what we are doing to these young lives. For those who have grown up, learned to live with their conditions, it can amount to things like chronic pain or reduced mobility. But it didn't have to be that way. It didn't have to be that a person's condition got progressively worse because we didn't try. It is not our right, it is not our place to let things fall by the wayside. Monitoring, keeping in the forefront that what looks like a collection of numbers, a statistic on paper, are actually men and women, boys and girls, people with jobs, families, hopes, dreams, education, and potential to change the world. And it's not up to us to shortchange them. It's up to us to be that someone who says, I believe you can achieve, and I will help you. This has been HandyLink. I'm your host, Cam Wells, reminding you we're all equal. So get on out there and have yourselves a good one. You've earned it, folks. We'll see you next week.